Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Sai's glory, his divine story. Every Thursday on Morning Glory. Catch the vibe with me, Karuna Munshi, on Radio Sai's Thursday Live on Asia Stream at 9:40 a.m. Om Shri Sai Ram. Loving salutations at the lotus feet of Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba, the voice, the ears, and the heart and soul, as well as the love and life of everyone associated with Radio Sai, including Radio Sai listeners around the world. Sai Ram and good morning, dear listeners, and welcome to Morning Glory on Thursday Live. You are tuned to our Asia stream coming to you live from Prashanthi Nilayam, India, the spiritual capital of the universe. My name is Karuna and it's my divine privilege to be your host this morning. Current time in the abode of Supreme Peace right now is 9:41 a.m., actually just turned 9:42 a.m. Indian Standard Time. Thank you for staying with us on this pleasant Thursday, November the 3rd, 2016. November is an extraordinary month for all of us, as it marks the sacred birth anniversary of our Lord. As you can imagine and expect, Radio Sai will be celebrating this momentous event throughout this month with so very many special and new offerings, including a new series, Self-Reflection, starting here, right here, right now on Morning Glory. But first, let's quickly turn our attention to the weather conditions prevailing in the Divine Valley. Since Diwali, last Sunday, the weather in Prashanthi Nilayam is cooling down, but only at night times. This week, our average lows overnight are around 21 degrees Celsius, and every day they continue to decline by about a degree to a very pleasant 20, 19, 18, and so on. I don't think they ever go below 16 here in Parthi. So daytime highs, however, are continuing to hover in the mid-30s. Hopefully, those two will begin to slide by mid-November. Here's what's making news at this hour in Prashanthi Nilayam. The ashram is just about catching its breath after the energetic and energizing Diwali celebrations by the devotees from the state of Gujarat. From fast-paced dances to the folk music to classical music to grand dramas, the devotees from the state of Gujarat celebrated the Festival of Lights with great joy and devotion in the Divine Presence, marking the beginning of festivities galore that Prashanthi Nilayam hosts every November. November is a month of non-stop celebrations here. Coming up this month, we have, of course, the Global Akhanda Bhajan, Ladies' Day, Convocation of the Sai University, and of course, the biggest celebration of the year, on November 23rd, the day of the divine advent of Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba. This year we will be celebrating the 91st birth anniversary of our beloved Lord, and the buzz is that we can look forward to some outstanding offerings of love and devotion by way of programs and presentations in the Mandir. Meanwhile, today the abode of Supreme Peace is experiencing a wonderful recharge of sorts. The overall climate has undergone a sea change because Baba's beloved students are back from their winter break, and they're back in thousands as always. Along with them are their parents and their chaperones. The back-to-school buzz is especially prominent in the Mandir, so starting this weekend, you can expect the Vedam and Bhajans to once again be charged by the little voices of the primary school children, as well as the deep and full-throated recitation by university students. With the resumption of the second school term, our slice of heaven is once again running full throttle. This term goes really fast, with so many festivals coming up in November. And then, we begin the sports day preparations with Christmas and New Year celebrations along the way. The annual sports and cultural meet goes on from 11th of January to 15th or so. After that, the students settle down to some serious studying till Shivratri. Soon after Shivratri, it's exam time. And you know how time just flies extra fast around here. We also have a number of Parthi Yatras and group visiting us throughout this period and presenting their programs in the Mandir. Meanwhile, through all this excitement, the students here are so focused, disciplined, and trained to multitask and juggle without losing their concentration. That with Baba's divine grace, our schools will continue to top in academic examinations at national levels. Only God could achieve this. Now, given the excitement of the 91st birthday on November 23rd, here in the Divine Valley, seekers have started to arrive every single day from every single part of this vast country and of the world itself, all through the day and often at night as well. And that excitement is percolating to Morning Glory as well, so it is time for me to share with you the lineup of programs this morning. Feature presentation. Today we will debut our special series, Self-Reflection, as an offering at the Lotus Feet in honor of the Divine Birthday coming up on November 23rd. And Self-Reflection will be followed by a brand new episode of Tris with Divinity. Today's episode features a young adult from USA, Mr. Kishore Chundi. So over now to Self-Reflection by Mr. K. Chakravarti. Today, you will listen to episode 1. Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome to Self-Reflection on Radio Sai. Self-Reflection is a unique presentation to honor the 91st birthday anniversary of Bhagwan Baba. In this series, we have Mr. K. Chakravarti, a long-standing devotee and a member of the Sri Satya Sai Central Trust, read out articles that he has penned for various commemorative volumes that were published during landmark birthdays of our Lord Sai in the period 1990 to 2016. Today, you will hear Mr. Chakravarti share the very first reflection in this series, entitled Reminiscences and Reflections. He had penned it for a special volume, Sai Vandana, published in 1990. This self-reflection was recorded at the Radio Sai Studios on October the 12th, 2016. And here it is for your inspiration and listening pleasure.
Reminiscences and Reflections. In my end is my beginning. We shall not cease from exploration, and the object of all our exploring will be to find where we started and know the place for the first time. These lines of T.S. Eliot from his four quartets echo my feeling regarding my first meeting of Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba, whom we reverentially and lovingly call Swami. And my continued quest thereafter during the last 15 years and more. Looking back, I feel that my first meeting with Bhagwan in May 1975 marked in some way the end of my previous self and the beginning of my new self. to all intents and purposes, I've continued to remain the same. But in some fundamental way, I've changed. And that change is more in the realm of inner core, of the deeper recesses of my psyche. I believe that my life has, in its vital, emotional and spiritual aspects, taken some dimension which may not have come about at all were it not for such meeting. God, until then, was an abstract concept. He was someone out there in the far-flung heaven, beyond outer space. After being taken under the protective umbrella of Bhagwan, the feeling I have is that God is a living reality with visible shape and color. Is it that the distant one has become near or the formless one has taken form? Well, Bhagwan has been here in this form long before I came to know of him. He has taken other forms at other times, in times past. But what is real to me is a personal feeling that I have that the Divine has chosen to express itself in this form and in this age. Seemingly insignificant things take on significance in one's life. One can rationalize by saying that everything has a purpose, meaning and reason, and nothing happens by chance or fortuitously. The teleological view may be. It is human nature to find reason, logic and cause in the events and happenings. It is the individual's way of looking at things rather than proof of self-existing and self-subsisting universal causal paradigm that would matter in the end. I prefer to attribute a certain destiny to my meeting with Bhagwan. Judged by later events, I cannot dismiss it as a chance occurrence. I also consider it as expressing an unfoldment of new significance to my life. It was May 18, 1975. The previous day, while my wife and I were talking to the chief of police in the district administration, we were asked as to whether we would like to go over to Puttaparthi to see Baba. I had been at Anantapur for more than 2 months by then. I had no natural inclination to go and meet religious heads or eminent spiritual personages until then. It was only later that I could know that I was not coming to meet a religious head or a spiritual personage, but the Divine Manifest. So when I was asked about a visit to Puttaparthi, I kept quiet. My wife expressed a certain keenness to go, along with my colleague and his wife. We were told that we could start by 5 in the morning. My wife said that since I had some reservations about the visit, we could come at a more leisurely hour. My colleague said that it would be fine if we could reach Puttaparthi by 5 in the evening. So it was that on May 19th, which happened to be my birthday, according to the Indian calendar, we reached Puttaparthi around 4:45 p.m. after attending to my official work en route. When we reached by 4:45 p.m., my colleague said that we must hurry up and go to Mandir. Hardly did we sit down, then Bhagwan came out. There, for the first time, I saw him in flesh and blood. I had seen a few pictures of him. Somehow I imagined, seeing those pictures, that he would be tall and massive and the hair rather rough. But here he was before me, light and petite, slender and graceful, his hair forming itself into a natural crown. His appearance itself was the first surprise. He summoned us in with a beatific smile. As I was driving the car with my wife towards Puttaparthi, my wife asked me as to what we could talk to Bhagwan. Having had no experience of visiting any such personages, I said, "I'll have hardly anything to say, but if it comes to talking, well, we can always talk about the 18th chapter of Gita. So we settled down, with Bhagwan also sitting on the floor. He said, looking at me, that he would talk on some spiritual subject. There was a pause, and then he asked me, how about 18th chapter of Gita? That was quite a surprise. Well, I did not know whether he consciously knew what I told my wife in the car. I nodded, and he started speaking. In the course of the next 10 or 15 minutes, he tenderly called me by name a few times to inquire as to whether I agree with what he said. I was thinking to myself, I have met Baba just a few minutes back. He calls me by my name as though he has known me for a long time. He continued talking. A few minutes later, during his talk, he asked again, isn't it so, Chakravarti? Then he looked deep into my eyes and said, I may be new to you. You are old to me. Was it another surprise? It was as though the curtain had fallen, the veil lifted, albeit for a fleeting moment. T.S. Eliot's words ring in my memory. Time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future, and time future contained in time past. I must say that although I have had a fairly orthodox religious background at home, my mental reaction was more Western oriented, possibly due to the type of formal education. I had no disbelief in God, but somehow God was not a very integral part of my life until then. So when I was asked by Bhagwan after his talk as to what my response was, I said, Baba, that's how I addressed him for the first time. Hinduism explains away, it does not explain. He then said, what is beyond words cannot be explained in words. You have to experience it in due course. Then after a pause, he continued, a person who waters a plant waters it at the roots. He does not pour water on the leaves. I have just watered your root. It will take time to grow. It looks to me that Bhagwan has been pouring water as a zealous gardener. I hope I have grown a little. I cannot claim I have grown to be a big tree, but that's not the fault of the gardener. Some plants in his garden take a long time to grow. When we were returning after the first visit, my wife said, it would have been good if you had brought the children with us. They would have enjoyed meeting Baba. She also said, Baba perhaps gives only vibhuti. He does not seem to be giving kumkum. A month after our visit, my wife came to see Bhagwan with the district police chief's wife. I could not come. During her second visit, Bhagwan told her, you and Chakravarti felt that you should have brought the children. Next time, when you come, bring the children. Was it a surprise again? A few minutes through that interview, and then he looked at my wife and told her, you asked for kumkum, isn't it? Have permanent kumkum. He materialized a ring with red colored stone, symbolizing red kumkum. Was she given another surprise? Well, by then, I suppose surprise ceased to be surprise, as anything seemed to be possible with Bhagwan. My wife was naturally in a very happy frame of mind when she returned to Anantapur. During dinner, when she narrated to me what had transpired, I said, well, I cannot wear such ordinary stone ring. I can only wear a diamond ring. I thought I had said something light and funny. A few days after this, Bhagwan sent two senior persons in the Sri Satya Sai organization to meet and invite me to inaugurate Gokulam at Puttaparthi. That was during the second half of August. I was very glad to accept the invitation. I came to Puttaparthi with my family. And after the function was over, we went into the mandir. And after talking to us, he was about to retire. We had taken Pada Namaskaram. I was about to come out of his room in the mandir. He smiled at me, waved his hand in a circle a few times, introduced something, polished it in his robe, and asked me to extend my right hand. And when I did so, he said with a smile, "Here is a beautiful and precious diamond ring. Wear it." I was speechless. Did he hear my light-hearted comment to my wife? When she showed the ring Bhagavan gave her, was it at another surprise? At this rate, our lives will be full of surprises. And surprise will be the rule of life, I thought, and so it has been. A month after this, when we came to Puttaparthi, while talking to Bhagavan, my wife prayed to him that he should perform the Upanayanam of our sons. He said that whenever my mother and brother came along with us, then he would perform it. We returned to Anantapur. On my return, there was a telegram from my brother saying that he would be coming to Anantapur with our mother after 4 days. There was no indication at all that they would be coming then. In fact, according to the original plan, they were to come after 2 months. We all went to Parthi. On earlier occasions, Bhagavan used to call us after our arrival by 7 a.m. and talk to us. We used to leave Puttaparthi by 8:30 a.m. and be back to Anantapur by 10 to be in time for my office work. The day when we came to Parthi with my mother, brother and the children happened to be Vijayadashami day. There was no Dasara celebration that year. Around 9 a.m., I was informed that Bhagavan is very busy, that I can go back to Anantapur if I wanted to. I said that I was not in a hurry and that I could stay. At 10 a.m., 11 a.m., and again at 12 noon, the same message was brought that Bhagavan was still busy, that I could return. I sent reply that I would like to stay for the day and wait till Bhagavan was free to see us. By 12:15, there was a knock on my door and I was informed that Bhagavan wanted us to come to Purnachandra Auditorium. We all went there. Swami came and said that since he was busy directing the students for the forthcoming drama, Jesus the Son of Man, he sent word that we could go back to Anantapur and come some other day. He was gracious and spoke to us all. My wife then reminded him about the Upanayanam of the children. Bhagavan asked as to when she would like to have it. And my wife replied almost exuberantly, "Now, Swami." He thought for a moment and said that we would perform it at 4:35 p.m. And he did so. I have narrated the above because of what I learnt about the occasion 2 or 3 months later. I was informed by 2 of the senior devotees who were with Bhagavan during the drama rehearsal, where he mentioned to them, "Chakravarti is here. I'm asking him to go. But if he stays today, his life will take a turn in a particular direction. If he goes away, his life will take another turn. I did stay, and that's why my life had taken the direction of turning my life Godwards. Or shall I say, Swami words." To have been given the good sense to stay for that day was, I think, an act of grace of Bhagavan. I do not feel that I can take credit for exercising my free will wisely.
Sai Ram, you're tuned to Radio Sai's special series, Self-Reflection. You're currently listening to Mr. K. Chakravarti reading out his article, Reminiscences and Reflections, written for a special volume, Sai Vandana, in 1990. This self-reflection was recorded at the Radio Sai Studios on October the 12th, 2016. Please continue to stay with us for the rest of this narrative.
In February 1976, in response to our prayers, Bhagwan came to our house at Anantapur. It was the day of my father-in-law's death anniversary. While taking food, Bhagwan told my wife, "I have given liberation to your father." We were rendered speechless. Tears welled up in our eyes. Not only was Bhagwan looking after us in this life and on this earth, he was looking after those who had departed from amidst our family. Indeed, a savior in this life and in the life beyond. In July, I was transferred to Hyderabad from Anantapur. I had sought Bhagwan's permission to take leave for about 20 days and spend the time with him before joining my new assignment. After spending days with him, the time came for us to leave for Hyderabad. My wife was feeling quite sad. The night before the day of our departure, she sat outside the room, well past midnight. The next morning, when Bhagwan came to our room, he said, "You did not sleep last night and are crying. I'll give you the rare opportunity of looking after the school at Hyderabad, which I have set up recently. I shall appoint you as the director and correspondent of my school. Do you think you are losing a link with me? Don't worry. I shall provide you 100 links with me." Looking at me, he said, "Government may send you away from here, but I shall not send you." Once again, I did not understand then what those words meant. But looking back, we know that the assurance he gave then was fulfilled by him. He appointed me as the registrar of his deemed university when it was set up. But another 5 years before that happened. During those 5 years, there have been many instances of his grace and mercy expressing itself. On one occasion, I was driving the car from Madras to Hyderabad. My wife and children accompanied me. After we crossed Nellore on the highway, I was speeding up. It was nearing 6 in the evening. I had overtaken a lorry just ahead of a bridge. As I overtook the lorry, I suddenly found that the road got narrowed and the earth below had been washed away, perhaps during the rains a few days earlier. I was driving the car at 100 km speed. I applied the brake and my wife and children shouted, "Sai Ram." The car stopped within a few feet. I got down and asked others to sit still. I found the right front wheel was projecting out and below was a chasm. Even to this day, I do not know how the car got so precariously poised. I cannot claim to have stopped the car by effectively applying the brake. We believe that a more efficient braking system was applied from wherever Swami was. 1977, I was deputed to undergo a refresher course in one of the hill stations for a fortnight. After about a week of the course, I had a nasty fall in the bathroom. when I felt something like a temporary blackout. When I regained consciousness, I found that there is a gash in my jaw and the bone was visible. I must have hit some sharp edge as I fell down. There was a rusty water closet over my head and I seemed to have pulled it as I fell. When I got up, I found that it had not luckily fallen on my head. I was taken to the hospital and the doctor put a few stitches. I did not inform my wife about it over the telephone or telegram. I returned with the bandage and stitches on after 2 days when the course was over. She was visibly upset seeing me in that condition. She asked me as to what happened and when. I narrated to her. She then said that around the time the accident happened to me, her Mangalsutra gave way as she was playing with our dogs. She got panicky with the thought that something bad had happened to me or is about to happen. Her immediate response was to convey what she considers a bad omen to Bhagwan and got assurance from him that he will look after me. She was able to convey the message to Bhagwan, and in less than half an hour she got the return message from Puttaparthi. "Your message to Swami conveyed. Swami said that he will be always with Chakravarti and look after him. Madam, one more thing. Swami told that you should not take compost tablets." Actually, she was planning to take compost tablets to overcome her agitation and restlessness. A day or two later, Bhagwan sent Vibhuti Prasadam to my wife through some devotees coming from Hyderabad and asked them whether they had seen me before coming to Puttaparthi. Bhagwan mentioned to them as to how he saved me from what would have otherwise been a fatal accident. He sent word through them that when I get better, I should come to Puttaparthi with my wife. As soon as the stitches were removed, my wife and I came to Puttaparthi. He called me and my wife for interview, during the course of which he said that he had given me another life in order to fulfill his promise to my wife during the first interview that he will keep her as a Mangali. To reaffirm it, he solemnized our marriage again. That was indeed a touching moment. Such divine intervention guards, protects, modifies. And sometimes the divine does not apparently intervene. What does one make out of these? It's very difficult to say. Divine intervention in the way we wish things to happen reaffirms our faith. But faith built on such incidents can be fragile. One cannot prove or disprove the existence or otherwise of the divine on this basis. True faith in the spiritual sense does not depend on anything good happening or bad not happening, because it is founded on the belief that whatever happens to one, it is a gift of God. And further, that there is nothing like joy and sorrow, because both are equally temporary. And real happiness lies in developing an attitude of equanimity which treats joy and sorrow alike. To read a well-known sloka as the following in Bhagavad Gita is one thing. Treating alike pain and pleasure, gain and loss, victory and defeat, engage yourself in battle. Thus, you will incur no sin. But to conduct oneself in life accordingly is yet another. That's why Bhagwan tells us often that instead of memorizing or getting by heart a string of slokas from Gita, observe in practice just one sloka and life would then be sanctified and spirituality attained. Through the years of my stay at Hyderabad, I was able to visit Puttaparthi and Vrindavan to have darshan of Bhagwan. Slowly, deep within me, was also growing a feeling that even as my physical and mental faculties are reasonably all right, I should seek Bhagwan's permission to take voluntary retirement and come to Puttaparthi and do whatever work was assigned. For more than a year, almost every month when I came for darshan, I made repeated requests. Every time Bhagwan put me off with one explanation or other as to why I should continue to be in the Indian administrative service. But in October 1981, he gave me permission to come and join as registrar of his institute. He said that it is time to leave IAS and join SAI. Reversal of alphabets. It has been more than that. I had moved from my incessant journey in the external world to my voyage inwards. The last 9 years of my association with the institute had been providing me many opportunities to be in the proximity of Bhagwan, both as the revered chancellor of the institute and as the divine chancellor of the universe. It has been a constant process of unlearning, learning, and relearning. I have been asked by many such questions as the following. Do such experiences with Baba prove his divinity? In fact, how does one recognize the divine? Do experiences occur because of faith? Or faith is born out of such experiences? Why are similar experiences not felt by many? If the divine has to claim scientific validity, should not all people get similar experiences under similar circumstances? Some are saved from accidents and some are not. Some are cured of the diseases and some continue to suffer from those diseases. There are rich and poor, strong and weak, lucky and unlucky, successful and unsuccessful, bright and foolish. If all such inequalities are inborn, then the divine is irrelevant. If they cannot be cured, then the divine is not omnipotent. I used to get upset by such questions earlier, but I now come to feel that there are no intellectual answers to such questions. There's a simple and straight answer. The divine is with us in the form of Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba, for those with eyes to see and mind to accept. All such questions relate to the realm of dichotomy and division. We cannot try to mechanically reconcile life's contradictions. We can only experience the transmutation of the opposites. And such transmutation can come only from a constant consciousness that the world of external objects and experiences are not the final and total reality. Life will have to move from inconsistent multiplicity to transcendent unity. That is to say, we will have to understand the limitations of body, mind and senses through which we perceive only the multiplicities and contradictions, and recognize the expansiveness of soul and spirit which harmonizes and unifies. We'll have to recognize that the real can be obtained only through the unreal, the permanent through the fleeting, the eternal through the perishable. Have I found the place where I started? I seem to be in the process of finding. How long will it take? Can it be found in this lifetime itself? Or will it take more lives? At least I know I'm on the royal road, though many miles to go. But with Bhagwan as a goal, as a road, and as a guide, I'm sure to cover the miles. Thank you. Thank you.
Sairam, dear listeners, you just heard Mr. K. Chakravarti read out his article, Reminiscences and Reflections, that he had written for a special volume, Sai Vandana, in 1990. This self-reflection was recorded at the Radio Sai Studios on October the 12th, 2016. Today's reading was the first in a series of self-reflections, a special program in honor of the 91st birthday celebrations of Bhagwan Baba. Mr. K. Chakravarti is a long-standing devotee of Bhagwan Baba and a member of the Sri Satya Sai Central Trust. And in this series, Self-Reflection, he reads out articles that he had penned for various commemorative volumes published during landmark birthday celebrations of Bhagwan Baba over a period of 26 years, from 1990 to 2016. Dear listeners, we look forward to your feedback to this special presentation. You can reach us by email at listener@radiosai.org. Thank you for your company, and please continue to stay tuned to Radio Sai Global Harmony, coming to you from Prashanti Nilayam, India. Sai Ram.
Ram, and welcome back to Morning Glory on Thursday Live. Today is the 3rd of November 2016 and the current time in the ashram right now is 21 minutes past 10 a.m. Indian Standard Time. You just heard the very first episode of Self-Reflection by Mr. K. Chakravarti. And dear listeners, we are eagerly looking forward to your feedback to this 91st birthday special presentation. You know how to get to us, listener@radiosai.org. For the rest of this month, till the end of the year, actually, because there are 9 Thursdays starting today till the end of this year, 2016, I will be playing an episode every week on Morning Glory. Some narratives by Mr. Chakravarti are barely 15 to 17 minutes long, while others go up to half an hour. So, I hope you will stay with us and share the joy and the pleasure of listening to these lot of gravitas in what he says and very succinctly written reflections. Lot of emotion there as well, and you will find there's a lot of behind the scenes detail and which we were never aware of before. So, I really enjoyed just sitting across from him and recording these quite recently when he spared the time to come down to the studio. And I am so eager to share the same with you because there was a lot of learning, a lot of love in what he said. And it's very hard to understand anybody, what they're going through, till you hear them describe their relationship with Swami and you get a totally different perspective. So please continue to stay with us on Morning Glory every Thursday and enjoy these 9-part series of self-reflections. And now, for those of us, and by the way, yes, I will be waiting for your emails. You know the email ID, listener@radiosai.org. In fact, you can start sending your emails now if you so wish. And in case you're planning to visit Prashanti Nilayam in the near future, I have some very useful news for you from our planetarium, which is known as the Sri Satya Sai Space Theatre. The planetarium is open to visitors for regular shows 6 days a week. Every single day except midweek on Wednesday. No show on Wednesday. All other weeks we have a show. Entry is on first-come, first-served basis and it begins at 10 a.m. and the show starts at 10:30 a.m. The duration of the show is approximately half an hour. Special shows can be arranged for school and college pupils or large groups of above 120 people. And you can have them arranged for you and your group or your state or your Balvikas group or your Parthi Yatra by contacting the ashram's public relations office. The ashram's public relations office is located on the South Indian Canteen Road, just opposite the South Indian Canteen. And in case you have missed, it's very hard to miss, our planetarium is on the main avenue that leads to Puttaparthi, to Prashanti Nilayam, right beside the university and opposite the hostel. So it has quite a distinct architecture, so you cannot miss the Sri Satya Sai Space Theatre. And dear listeners, did you know that if you visit our planetarium, language is not a barrier? That is because we are probably the only space theater in the world that offers a 45 planetarium shows in 3 to 5 languages. The 3 languages are English, Hindi and Telugu, and the other 2 are Malayalam and Tamil. Now, every visitor in the same show can select a language of their choice by pressing the button on their headphone. Your headphone gives you the leeway to select your language. So the person next to you might be watching in Malayalam while you're watching it in English, and it doesn't matter. Everybody is watching the same visual, but you're listening to a soundtrack in a language of your choice. And another interesting trivia is that last year alone, 90,000 guests attended our planetarium shows here in Prashanthi Nilayam. That's quite a number. I think the planetarium Hawaii has a similar number, 90,000 guests per year. If you want to learn more details about the Sri Satya Sai Space Theatre or our planetarium, you can visit our website at saispace.in. Saispace is one word, SAISPACE.IN for India. Dear listeners, now you may recall that last week on Morning Glory, I asked our listeners a slightly more complex question than usual. I asked you to tell us what sort of self-transformation you wish to offer Bhagwan Baba on his 95th birthday. Only about 4 or 5 people responded to that question, although on most Thursdays we get about 25 to 35 responses on average on Morning Glory. I was wondering what happened here. But anyway, it's nice that one listener responded quite recently. Prashanti from Indiana, USA wrote, and I quote her, she said, "Self-made promises and resolutions mostly last only days in my case. Many times in my prayer, out of gratitude, I shed tears asking Swami, what can I do for Him for the abundant grace He's showering on me? And here comes the answer through you, that transformation is the best gift that will make Swami very proud of us. Recently, I watched a Samarpan talk which reminded me how much Swami insisted upon moderation in everything, including desires, food, sleep, speech, dressing, enthusiasm, etc., etc. So the universal value I would like to cultivate more is peace. And the major obstacle that's stopping me to experience inner peace is moderation, especially in speech. When I get excited because of anger or happiness, I realize I don't exhibit patience and act hastily, which disturbs my calm and sometimes hurts me and or others. So I would like to try and inculcate moderation in as many aspects as I can and give Swami the peace I experience out of it. Swami, bless me, for nothing is possible without your grace." Unquote. That was from Prashanti in Indiana, USA. Nice resolve, Sister Prashanti, and it definitely applies to each of us who prays in the name of Swami. All of us can learn to be more moderate in everything we express and consume and desire. By the way, dear listeners, you're tuned to Morning Glory on Thursday live on Radio Size Asia Stream. And today is the 3rd of November 2016. And the time in the ashram right now is precisely 28 minutes past 10 a.m. Indian Standard Time. And this is the perfect moment for me to play for you a wonderful new episode of Triswit Divinity with the bright and brilliant Sai Young Adult from USA. Today you will hear part one of this interview, and I will bring you its conclusion right here on Morning Glory next Thursday. Over now to Mr. Kishore Chundi, a Sai Young Adult, in conversation with my colleague, Mr. Bishu Prushti. I urge you, dear listeners, to share your feedback with us by email at listener@radiosai.org. Please enjoy this interview, and I will catch up with you next Thursday right here on Morning Glory with part two of Triswit Divinity with Kishore Chundi and the second episode of Self-Reflection by Mr. K. Chakravarti. Till we meet again, please be well and have a saisam awesome day. Jai Sai Ram. And here is the interview.
Saram, dear listeners, and welcome to this special episode of Trist with Divinity. And I call this a special episode because today we have a teenager, a youngster, talking about his tryst with Sai. And the World Youth Festival has just concluded 2-3 days ago, and he's one among the 3,000 youth come from over 70 countries to participate in this beautiful celebration that really changed the complexion of Prashanthi Nilayam. There was so much of energy, so much of spiritual fervor, so much of positive vibes that filled this sacred hamlet, and he was blessed to be part of it. And he's someone who is also blessed in many ways, because he's been a brilliant student all his years in school. He topped his school. He was a valedictorian in St. Edward's School in Florida, and now he secured admission in Yale University to study philosophy and foreign language. So he's joining his graduation in Connecticut, but he also qualified to join Harvard and Oxford, but he chose Yale. So someone who has been extremely blessed by Bhagwan, talented, full of energy, a young soldier in Bhagwan's mission, and was very curious to know what was his draw to Bhagwan, you know. And like him, there were so many in this youth fest, and I thought we should not lose this chance to know from them what about Swami fascinates someone like Kishore Chundi. So welcome, Kishore, to this episode of Trust with Divinity.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So Kishore, the youth fest just concluded, and you always wanted to be part of it, the youth fest?
Yeah, so in 2013 was the first time I really heard about it. I was in Prashanthi. It was during the summer, July, about Guru Purnima time. And I met Shivendra uncle. Mr. Shivendra Kumar is the international youth coordinator.
Yes.
And I met him, and this was when he was on his first few months on the job. And he sort of explained to me his idea, his grand proposal, and several of the changes that he was going to implement, and it really appealed to me. And that's when I first really decided, you know, when I become a youth, I want to be part of this. Because in 2013 I was 15. I wasn't, you know, technically a youth as it's defined yet, but I knew that by the time, you know, the festival came, that I would be a youth, and that I'd certainly want to participate.
Mm. So you just became a youth and you're part of this festival. So it's a grand beginning to your sort of being a youngster and a Sai youth, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I'm so glad it happened, you know, this summer in July, just a month before I go to college and face that whole new set of challenges and environment. Mm. That's really a blessing.
So how do you think this youth fest prepared you for what is to come?
I think the biggest way it's prepared me is that it's helped me rediscover and reconnect with Bhagavan's teachings. But in another way, it's helped me because I've been able to meet with, interact with, talk with a lot of other youth who are either in my same position or have already been through the same experience that I'm about to go through. A lot of Sai youth, obviously, mm-hmm. with the same spiritual background, similar spiritual background that I have. And that's been the greatest blessing, because before I take that journey, I can now have some of that advice and wisdom from people who, like me, live in the U.S. or live, you know, in the West, who certainly have been exposed to Swami's teachings and who earnestly wish to follow those teachings. And people who face that struggle, that conflict sometimes of how much is too far, and how much can you go before it ceases to be Swami's teachings. And you can certainly hear from them, their experiences, their views about that, and that's what's been most helpful for me.
So what are those few learnings that you think will help you now?
So I had a great conversation with another Sai youth as we were going to the morning exercises in Hillview. It's pretty early. It starts at 4:30. So it takes 30-40 minutes to set up and get there. So in that meantime, I was talking with him, and he's also from the U.S., born and raised there. He recently graduated from an Ivy League college. He was also an athlete, a very good athlete there as well. And so I certainly could draw some parallels between himself and myself. And he was telling me about, not about his academic or athletic or achievements, but about his spiritual development in college and for the few years after that. And that was one of the most important moments that occurred for me during the youth festival, because he explained to me some of the struggles he faced in college, how he was able to overcome those struggles through prayer and obviously through Swami's grace, but most importantly by really just sticking to Swami's teachings. And one of the lessons I was able to pull out was, if you're having doubts, if you're having any conflicts about that, that's fine. You know, everyone has them. In fact, there's a Swami once was asked by, I think, a Swami student, the university, Swami, how do you control the mind? How do you stop having bad thoughts? And Swami responded and he said, Bangaru, this is the season. He was saying, in youth, a lot of times these come. And he says, that's okay. You know, Swami essentially said, it's okay. Follow my teachings. Do sadhana and by God's grace, you'll be fine. And so he essentially told me that the same thing. Just keep practicing your sadhana, keep praying, and the doubts, Swami will shower his grace and the conflicts will naturally dissolve and go away.
So you don't have to feel diffident if you have any doubts. You don't have to feel, how could this happen to me? Why am I getting these doubts? So you know, it's natural, and all you have to do is just follow Swami's teaching.
Yeah, there doesn't have to be any guilt or shame involved. It's part of the human experience. So just keep up the good fight, and it'll go away.
And you meet someone who has been there, done that.
Exactly.
And he's telling you that. So I think you would have met many people like this, isn't it?
Oh, of course. There's people like him. The festival was replete with people like him. But I was, you know, he was just you could call him, he was Swami's instrument to get to me.
Yes.
Maybe, I hope that I was Swami's instrument, maybe to connect with him on mm-hmm. some level as well. Mm-hmm.
So what were the other beautiful things about this festival that appealed to you?
There was lots of great speakers and speeches that we were able to hear, different topics. But one of the speeches that really stuck out to me was Dr. Narayan's speech. I don't remember the exact day. It was in the afternoon, I think, on the second day of the festival. And his speech was, on the surface, it seemed to be more of a secular speech. The theme of his speech was career. How to lead a successful career and grow in your career in a manner that reflects Swami's teachings. And Swami's always been very much a proponent of having a successful career in any path. In fact, he started I think an MBA program at the university, and some devotees originally, when he started, some devotees were skeptical, saying, Swami, do you really want to, you know, send all these students into the business world? You know, there's a lot of vices and cheating and lying that people have to do to be successful there. And Swami said, no, I want the leaders of the business world to be Swami students, to be those people that have those values and are successful not in spite of those values, but because of those values. And going back, obviously, to this, his speech really focused on that. And so he had three central points. His first point was, don't rush to judge anyone, whether it be a boss, a coworker, or just anyone in life in general. Because you'll find that people always have a background and a story, and you always have to understand that before you can pass any judgment whatsoever on them. The second point was, it's probably not best to make large long-term goals, but to focus on short-term goals, because when you do that, you can really follow God's plan for you and go just day by day with Him. And the third point was, don't get too comfortable. That is to say, embrace change, look for change, and try to progress. And again, it seems to be sort of a secular, career-minded speech on the outside, but really, once I started thinking about it, it actually encapsulated some of the most profound truths from all spirituality. So, you know, in the Bible, Jesus says, speaking of Dr. Narayan's first point, judge not lest you be judged. And he also, in the Sermon on the Mount, talks about, I think in chapter 7 of Matthew, how can you look at the mote, the speck in your brother's eye, when you have a log in your own eye? So first, essentially, examine your own faults and self-introspect, see what's wrong with me, and then don't even consider pointing out your brother or any person's faults or criticizing them for it until you've made a analysis and a record of your own faults and then have attempted to work on them. So that's another great spiritual truth that was encapsulated in the first point. And Swami, of course, many times has talked about the necessity for you to transform yourself before you try in any way to transform others. The second point he talked about was, again, about making short-term goals. And again, this is another truth found in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus talks about, you know, don't worry about your food for tomorrow, your clothing for tomorrow, your shelter for tomorrow. He says, God clothes the lilies in the field so resplendently. He will so clothe you. You're his children. You're not just a piece of grass. And so he goes on to say, and I'm not remembering the exact quote, but something along the lines of focus on the present, don't worry about, let the worries of tomorrow take care of themselves. And that's another, again, great spiritual truth that's found in that. Make short-term goals. Don't think about long-term ideas. Make short-term goals. Think about the now. Think about the immediate future and go about your life in that manner. And the third point, that is, go with progress, I think encapsulated the entire youth festival, the uniqueness of it. You know, in the zone workshops, people were, each zone had their own workshop. And in our workshop, the U.S. workshop, and the Zone 1 workshop, that is to say, the first, as a sort of icebreaker activity, was, you know, describe the youth festival in one word. And lots of, you know, great words were used, inspirational, motivating, rejuvenating, but someone said the word unique, and I think that's what hit the core of it, that there was a group, such a diverse group of like-minded individuals that came together to better themselves and to better each other, following Swami's teachings, of course. And Mr. Narayan's last point, to not get too comfortable, to move with progress, again, encapsulates that what actually transpired at the youth festival. While sticking to Swami's teachings, we had new programs that actually hadn't really been seen before. You know, the very first day they had sort of a TV radio jaunt at the Purnachandra session, and they sort of continued that same set and format throughout, and it kept everyone really, you know, focused. And I think that third point encapsulates that idea of progress. And Swami said many times, you know, don't be a prisoner of the moment. Look towards the future and try to keep up with change, all while sticking to my teachings. And the way you can develop that is by prayer. That fundamental discrimination. You know?
Yeah, fantastic. I think it's really beautiful that, you know, all the ideas that Mr. Narayan said, you were able to think deep and relate to what is mentioned in the Bible and to Swami's teachings. So definitely you have had a lot of interest in philosophy, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of that comes from my immediate family background. My great-grandfather, Dr. Adivi Reddy, Dr. Reddy's father, just recently passed away a year ago. He, you know, he wrote the 9, you know, Sai Spiritual Gems, the books on that. And he was always reading Vivekananda, several other Indian philosophers. And he was always just a very philosophical person. And he passed that down to Dr. Reddy, my grandfather. And he's always inculcated me with the spirit of, you can discuss anything with me, just make sort of logical points. If you use sound reasoning, I'll be okay with it. And of course that comes to a certain point where, yes, you can try and reason with God as much as possible, but after a certain point, once, you know, in the play yesterday, the Sai students play, the gurus say, test me as much as you want, but once you're satisfied, it must be 100% focused.
Yes.
Without any doubts. So we have to have that faith, that belief in Swami's teachings and Swami himself. But then anything outside, I thought they would say, yes, you can debate, you can reason, and you can philosophize to your heart's content. So I was very, very fortunate to have that in my family. And my dad, of course, who was, he has a philosophy degree from college in Western philosophy, but after marrying into a Thai family, he started studying more, you know, traditional Eastern philosophy, especially Radha Ramakrishna, St. Ramakrishna's philosophy. So I've been lucky enough to have that sort of wide-ranging exposure.
Mm. So yeah, definitely you've had a lot of exposure, and you yourself also have spent a lot of time studying some of these scriptures, isn't it? Now, when you read Swami's teachings and read the other scriptures, what is the sort of feeling that comes to you?
It's a feeling of contentment and reassurance, I'd say. Because, of course, Swami said lots of times, my teachings are the essence of the teachings of all religions. All the teachings of all religions are at the core of the same. The teachings of human values are present in all paths to God. But, of course, like I was saying, as human beings, we tend to doubt. Or not necessarily actively doubt, but just a question.
Yes.
And there's not always something wrong with that. Swami has even said,
exactly,
test me, prove me.
Yes.
I want you to.
Yes.
But after you come to that conclusion, then do not waver after that. So, you know, it's okay to just accept that and say, okay, you know, that's right, and all religions are the same, and what Swami says is the essence of that. But I was encouraged by my parents and just by my own, just sort of my heart, spiritual desire, you could say, to read, you know, other scriptures. And the first sort of scriptures that I've delved most deep into are the Christian scriptures, the Bible and the writings of Christian saints, you know, St. Francis, St. Lawrence, or Brother Lawrence, as to say, St. Augustine. And in reading those works and even doing those spiritual practices of Christian sorts of prayers and music and of listening to, for example, you know, recitations of the Quran or reading stories of the Buddha, through all that you can really just see that there is the same undercurrent of those five human values, and that Swami's teachings not only encapsulate those, but capture the fundamental essence of those teachings in a very simple but very beautiful way. And seeing that, actually reading and then being able to see that on both an intellectual and spiritual level was very, like I said, made me feel very contented and reassured.
Mm. Can you give an example?
An example. So, actually, I was lucky enough. So I was just at Mr. Chakravarti's house, and he was just relating this example. So on the cross, or Jesus is of course condemned by the Pharisees and Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, says, "I washed my hands," and so Jesus is condemned to death. And of course he's innocent, but as the Son of God, according to Christian theology, he must die so as to purify mankind, to absolve mankind of their sins. And Jesus is marked as guilty. He's literally carrying his own cross that he's going to be crucified on. He's walking through this path, Calvary, to the place that's called Golgotha. And on that place, you know, he will be crucified. And so it's obviously a very torturous experience. He's walking through there. He's put on the cross. He's nailed to the cross. Everyone is ridiculing him. In fact, they put a sign over his head that says, "Here is Jesus, King of the Jews." And it's supposed to be a very mocking, satirical remark. And he has two other criminals, because the punishment in that day for criminals is if you were a thief or a murderer, that you would be sentenced to death through crucifixion. And of course, he had two people that actually were guilty of their crimes, two thieves who were being crucified to his left and right. And they were sort of making fun of him too, but one of the thieves eventually understands Jesus and comes to know of Jesus and repents of his sins, and actually, in the Catholic Church at least, he's canonized as a saint, I think Saint Dismas. But you read there of suffering, of divine suffering. And we saw that the last, really, after Swami broke his hip the second time, of what seemed to be divine suffering. Of course, as people who aren't most of us at least, who aren't that spiritually evolved to have lost body consciousness, it seems as though when we imagine, you know, Jesus being crucified on the cross, or Swami not being able to walk, or being in the hospital those last 3 weeks, it's easy to see that as, wow, that's such suffering. But for those evolved sorts of souls, it's not suffering, it's a body suffering, and for them that doesn't mean anything. But the point is that God takes on human form, and God suffers often for the sake of mankind. And Swami, of course, the last 15 years, physically suffered for the sake of mankind. There's also, I think, a story previously that we heard during the youth festival that said, Swami, I'm trying to remember exactly what had happened. Yes, so I think it was either Mrs. Parks or it was the Indian doctor, the lady doctor that told the story. She said, one time, Swami was not eating food for breakfast in the morning. And everyone, you know, gets worried. You know, it's a very traditional Indian thing. Everyone has to eat and whatnot. So people were getting worried. They were asking Swami, you know, Swami, why aren't you eating? And he was quiet for a while. And then Swami said, I'm not eating because, some boy here who I'm very fond of had displeased his mother, had said something bad to his mother, and it's such a heinous sin that I'm taking on the suffering myself so that he won't have that karmic debt. So also Shirdi Sai, left his mortal coil due to tuberculosis. He took that on, according to Sacharita, from a devotee that had had it, so as to save the devotee. So in all these instances, you can see how God, in His infinite mercy, in whatever form He is, will take on the suffering of human beings or suffer for human beings so as to redeem them.
Wow. Fantastic. I think it is so beautiful when you start seeing the different avatars, and when you see every avatar's life is actually an essay of what they preached, if only we can understand. And just like you have now drawn a comparison between Bhagwan's life, and you know, you brought in Shirdi Sai and then Jesus, I think you extrapolate that to the Rama avatar, to the Krishna avatar, or to the other incarnations of the divine. I think such beautiful insights come to you, and then you know that he is, as someone said, you know, you can realize God through religion, but you know that religion is only a means. He's actually beyond religion.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think...
Sarvadeta Adhita Swarupa, beyond our names and
exactly,
forms.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think since you're doing this deep study, it's very heartening to know that, you know, you're getting these kind of understanding. So after having come to know Bhagwan, and, you know, after now that you're studying so much of these scriptures, what are those other beautiful moments of learning and moments of revelation that has come to you? And, you know, you feel so happy that, you know, thank God I know Swami, and, you know, I know His teachings. Thank God that I am touched by His love, and I am wiser by His wisdom.
So, I'm an avid sports fan in the U.S. baseball and basketball I follow. I play those two sports as well. And since I was very young, I played those two sports. And anyone that knows me will tell you that my personal flaws are I can get angry very easily, and I'm just a very sort of enthusiastic, emotional sort of person, right? And definitely in sports, you could see that come out a lot in the past, whether, you know, after a baseball game, so I'm a pitcher in baseball, right? Mm-hmm. You'll have a bad game, you know, like a bowler in cricket, you could say you give up a lot of runs. I'd get, you know, Swami says, what is the first mark of my devotee? Have equanimity. So I did not have that whatsoever. I would get down, I'd be sad, then a good game, oh wow, happy, 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 and then just up, down, roller coaster, mm-hmm. up and down like that. And I'd also get very either angry with teammates or not coaches, but sometimes I'd get angry with teammates when they would make mistakes. And that certainly wasn't good for either the welfare of the team or just for my own personal spiritual growth. But realizing that that's one thing that I've seen in my spiritual growth, is that by playing sports or by participating in those sports, I've been able to practice Swami's teachings. And having formerly been that way, I came to just grow after reading more about Swami and of course in these other scriptures as well, about equanimity, about the need to try as much as possible to remain calm and even minded despite ups and downs. I think if you ask my teammates, my coaches, and anyone who's watched me play last year or 2 years, they would say that I'm definitely a different player in terms of that aspect of me playing sports. That whenever, you know, a teammate messes up, I don't yell at them anymore. Or because, again, it comes back to that teaching of Jesus and of Swami. I mess up plenty of times pitching, too, or playing the field. Would I like it if they yelled to me? No. So I have to examine my own mistakes in this sense on the baseball field before I can even begin to yell at other people for their mistakes. And also about keeping a calm between losses and wins, or good performances, bad performance. Am I perfect with it? No. No one likes losing. Met likes losing. Everyone likes winning. But I've been able to become markedly better at handling losses and wins and staying more calm.
I think that is fantastic. In fact, as you were saying this, I was reminded of the talk by V.V.S. Lakshman. And he too said that for him the biggest blessing in his life was the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which his grandfather taught him. And that was all about maintaining equanimity. Mm-hmm. And that's what also Bhagwan in the interview room also led him on to when he was through a bad phase of his cricketing career. So it's really, really very beautiful that this is a very practical way of dealing with life. It's a practical way of utilizing the blessing of knowing Bhagwan, you know. And Bhagwan very clearly says the definition of my devotee is who practices equanimity. And if you can do that in the sports field, where you have so many ups and downs, I think slowly do you see yourself bringing that now from the sports field into other spheres of your life?
Yeah, exactly. That brings me to the most important things that I've learned or that I've taken from the youth festival. Of course, I've been taught and we've heard many times in Swami's discourses or in speeches by people, you know, there's no such thing as spiritual and secular life. Try and live all life as if it's spiritual, as if everything is imbued with Swami and with God's presence. Again, that's the difference between hearing it, okay, and then doing it, or actually practicing it. And before the youth festival, and not that it's necessarily the worst thing in the world, but I would sort of have my spiritual routine. Okay, I'll do this prayer, I'll sing this bhajans, I'll go do the seva project, you know, that weekend. And then, okay, during the week, yes, I wake up, I eat breakfast, go to school, go to sports practice, come home, do work, repeat. And I would do that, I would focus on that, then I would have my spiritual quote unquote time. And one thing I learned from the youth festival, that I took home, that really hit me from it, was hearing again and hearing people's personal experiences of, you can't compartmentalize your life. You can't say, okay, I'm going to do this and this and this, and they're all separate. You have to try and imbue every activity with spiritual meaning. And I think that's one thing that I've tried to do on the sports field, but that now I'm after the youth festival, I'm going to hopefully, with Swami's blessings, try and extend that to other spheres of my life.
Oh, fantastic. I think if your life in some way gets more divinized, more spiritualized, spirit comes forward in trying to deal with all the problems of life, and now that you're moving on to one of the challenging phases of your life, you're going to the college, I think definitely these values of equanimity, these values of trying to see God in everything, definitely, and with your background of philosophy, will definitely enrich your life, and that you are doing your graduation in philosophy. Bhagwan needs to mention, when I hear this word philosophy, Swami used to say that if you don't understand what you're doing, then you know it is full loss, Swami used to say. But you know, it's very interesting, I'm just sharing this with you, that you know, any PhD is always called a doctorate of philosophy.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me think that ultimately, this is the ocean, you know. This is ultimately whatever branch you may study. It could be medicine, it could be physics, it could be chemistry. But ultimately, this is the ocean into which everything has to merge, because this is the only place where you find real answers.
Exactly. And it's, again, it's, this is a science.
To life.
This is a science. And so you just said this because I was just having a conversation with Mr. Chakravarti, and he said this. He said, he was giving me practical advice for college, and he's saying, I know you want to study, okay, philosophy, literature, history, politics, probably some science courses. He says, in each, before you study them, he says, you need to understand the philosophy of history, the philosophy of science, the philosophy of literature before you take them.
Hmm.
So again, so that, it's very remarkable that he just said that, because,
And if you are good in this, you know, then you can sort out everything in life.
Yeah.
Because that is where the answers to all the real questions of life are.
Yes.
And it's really very beautiful that, you know, Bhagwan has led you on to it. And of course, in so many ways, Bhagwan has been guiding your life visibly and invisibly. And given that you come from a family which has been a devotee of Bhagwan for four generations. So what beautiful memories that you have of your association with Swami?
So the first, well, technically this isn't really a memory, but the first sort of major experience that I had with Bhagavan was when I was 1 year old. I came, and it was around the time of my birthday, in the summer. And I was lucky enough, I was seated on Swami's lap. The family was in the interview room, and I was, you know, kind of a rowdy baby, so I was crying a lot, yelling, kicking, screaming. And Swami was, you know, my parents were kind of like scared, like, why is he doing this? He's in Swami, he should calm down. But Swami was able to make a joke out of the situation to lighten, diffuse it.
Mm.
And he said, oh, you're trying to swim, aren't you? Because I was, you know, flailing and kicking around.
Mm.
So that was the first sort of, you know, just funny, small, short anecdote that I had with Swami.
Mm.
But then...
You're swimming in the love of Bhagwan.
Yes, yes, in the lap in the love of Bhagwan, yes. But the next event that I remember was in the interview room. I must have been 7 or 8. I was, me and my brother, Anand and I, were chanting some rudram. So we started, obviously the whole rudram takes, you know, 20 something minutes. So we didn't do the whole thing. We made maybe 5 minutes in, and Swami said, child, you know, stop. And then after that, he said, you know, Bangaru, you two are in the United States. Chanting rudram, it's good that you've learned this, but most importantly, when you go back, it's much more important that you focus on the human values and on these teachings in the U.S. So, rudram is good, chanting Vedas is good, but that's more important. And that's not to say that's advice for me and my brother. There's plenty of other people that, you know, for them, Vedam chanting could be a very important spiritual sadhana. But for us, and for those Swami's just personal guidance for us, you know, I'm in no way saying that everyone should necessarily follow that exactly to the T. But I think there is a general kernel to be taken from that, which is Vedam is great, but it's not necessarily universal, right? Whereas everything that's universal is human values. And that's what should be the center of our spiritual life.
The essence of the Vedas is universal.
Yes, exactly.
And human values are at the essence of, the Vedas.
Yes.
And the Vedas are in Sanskrit. And Sanskrit is a very, very coded language. You really need scholars of very high caliber, because Sanskrit has 9 grammars to actually decode what one particular word of Sanskrit means. If you have scholars of 9 grammars, they can, each scholar can give you 9 meanings.
Mm-hmm.
Through the lens of one stream of grammar.
Mm-hmm.
So potentially, every word of Sanskrit has 81 meanings.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Okay. So when we say that, you know, this is the meaning of Purusha Suktam, or this is the meaning of Sri Suktam, or this is the meaning of Medha Suktam, that's a very, very, very limited view.
Mm-hmm.
The very fact that the Vedas are the breath of God means the Vedas are Satya Dharma Shanti Prema Ahimsa and Prema.
Yes.
Yeah. So, if we don't understand that and we make it a mechanical routine and we forget the essence of what is what Vedas are made up of, then I think perhaps we are losing it. But I think that's where Bhagwan was so beautifully trying to tell you that, you know.
That is your Vedas. Practicing human values is your Veda. Now that I think about
practicing
that.
Practicing human values is what is Veda. Yes. Because that is the essence of the Vedas. Yeah, you can practice, you can chant the Vedas, but if you're chanting the Vedas, but if you're not understanding human values, then we're just losing it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a very powerful message. Yeah.
I didn't really see that until just now. But The next sort of experience would be that I remember is one time we were with Swami and my grandma from my dad's side, so my Nainama, said in Telugu, couldn't be there. She wasn't feeling that well, so she was with her husband, my grandfather, back in the States. But Swami had said, go tell your Nainama that I very much relish, enjoy eating her pachadis every day.
Oh.
Because in our family, yeah, it's like a Nainama, she's known for her pachadis. She makes lots of pachadis, very, very good pachadis. Mm. And so it was just another reminder of his omnipresence. And of his love for that devotee. You know, that was almost a sadhana for her, pouring her love into making those pachadis.
Mm.
You know, a very simple, pious woman. So for him, he knew that would mean a lot to her.
Yes. So these were, you know, some of these instances perhaps also would have confirmed in you the faith, like you always knew that, you know, Bhagwan is divine because you were born into a family, but these kind of instances, did it sort of confirm, reaffirm, reiterate what you've been hearing?
Yes, of course, especially that last one about with the pachadis. But I think the biggest thing that reaffirmed and reassured me was, like I was saying, when I started to just read more of and examine more of the scriptures of other religions and other teachers, and to find that there were the same as Swami's, and that Swami's teachings were at the essence of all those scriptures. That was the biggest thing for me.
Wow. So your draw to Swami is his teachings.
Yes, because Swami's always said, you know, miracles are visiting cards, so to speak. Yeah. And you find inspiring stories of Swami devotees, some of the most, that haven't, I guess you could say, been lucky in quote unquote sense of the term as me and my family to have had that physical proximity to Swami, but devotees whose faith is undoubtedly much stronger than I could ever imagine, because they have that firm belief, not in the, they don't need the visiting card, so to speak. They have the just that connection, that one-on-one connection with Swami. And, you know, Swami says, I'm like a physician. I spend the most time with those who need it. So I needed a lot of those visiting cards because I guess Swami would say that was just how I am to just reaffirm that faith.
Amazing.